This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. British media say the calls for an end to the monarchy are growing stronger after the death of Queen Elizabeth. Kyiv says it's pushing back Russia's military from strategic holdouts in the east, while Moscow says it's hitting Ukrainian army positions in the Kharkiv region. And millions of Muslim pilgrims are heading toward the Iraqi city of Karbala. Ahead of Arbaeen, religious rituals commemorate the third Shia Imam. Thanks for joining us. Calls are growing louder for an end to the British monarchy, with many starting to debate the relevance of the royal family since the death of Queen Elizabeth on Thursday. The main anti-monarchy group, Republic, says that it is getting an influx of supporters on social media and elsewhere. But the group says that many people are refraining from openly expressing their opinions because they do not want to cause offense amid the emotional atmosphere and media focus on the story. The Republic is instead inviting people to be vocal and not feel intimidated. It says that they have every right to speak their minds about monarchy as a public office. Following Queen Elizabeth's death, her eldest son Charles has been named the king. His accession to the throne was proclaimed at a ceremony on Saturday. A correspondent in London, Saeed Pourreza, says anti-royal sentiment and republicanism have been gaining momentum in the UK over time.
These calls have been around for a long time. For one, you have a prime minister now in this country who, at one point in her career as a Republican, called for the monarchy to be abolished. And this goes back to the 1990s. She may have since changed her mind, but that's what she said back then. So did many other people. You're looking at a time when one in four Britons are now considering the monarchy as an anachronistic institution that has to be gone, now that the queen, that was the figurehead of this institution for some 70 years, is gone, has passed away and will be laid to rest on September 11th. If you look at the different age groups have different feelings and ideas of the monarchy. There are statistics out there, for example, saying that if you look at the younger generation, people between the ages of 18 and 24, they say they don't see the point of the monarchy, that it doesn't belong to the 21st century and it has to be done away with. But then over 65s seem to want the monarchy to stay around. So opinions are split, not just in the UK, but in other countries as well, in the so-called realms where the queen was now the king, Charles III, the head of state.
As the war with Russia enters its 200th day, Ukraine is claiming rapid advances in its offensive to retake territory in the east. The Ukrainian military says large parts of land spanning up to 3,000 square kilometers have been recaptured since the beginning of the counteroffensive this month. That is around one-third larger than the total area announced by President Volodymyr Zelensky one day earlier. Ukraine also says its troops are closing in on the eastern city of Lysychansk, captured by Russia 2 months ago. An offensive is also ongoing around the Russian-held Kherson region in the south, with Moscow dispatching reinforcements there. Zelensky says this winter could bring greater territorial gains if the West delivers more powerful weapons to Ukraine.
I believe that this winter is a turning point, and it can lead to the rapid deoccupation of Ukraine. We see how the Russian forces are fleeing in different directions. If we were a little stronger with weapons, we could deoccupy faster.
Russia has confirmed the drawdown from eastern Kharkiv, but says its troops are regrouping along the Donetsk front. Moscow also says its forces are hitting Ukrainian army positions in the Kharkiv region with precision, air, missile, and artillery strikes. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials have reported 10 injuries in Russian missile strikes in the cities of Mykolaiv and Dnipro. Staying with Ukraine, operations at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant comes to a complete halt. The state agency in charge of the facility says it has disconnected one of the power units at the site for safety purposes, leading to a halt in operations at the power station. According to the agency, preparations are underway to cool down the plant. A few days ago, Kiev asked local residents to evacuate Russian-held areas around the facility for their own safety. Russia and Ukraine accuse each other of risking a nuclear disaster by shelling the power station. The UN has called for the surrounding areas to be demilitarized. More cities in Europe are switching off the lights as the continent braces for worsening energy crunch amid tensions with Russia. In France, officials are cutting back lighting of the monumental Eiffel Tower as a symbolic gesture to increase public awareness around the crisis. Earlier, officials in the northern city of Lille stopped lighting of public buildings to reduce energy consumption ahead of winter. Germany is also switching off the spotlights, illuminating 200 of its historic buildings and monuments. A number of towns and cities in Austria and Italy have also reduced street lighting or turned off commercial signs in order to tackle galloping energy prices. A significant share of electricity in Europe comes from natural gas, which is currently in short supply. Russia has indefinitely suspended the delivery of gas to the continent, citing technical issues which it blames Western sanctions. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off in decades. Rami Mazzeri has more from Paris.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2%, and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In Sweden, people are heading to the polls for general elections. The polls pit the ruling Social Democrats against an unprecedented alliance between the right and the anti-immigration far right. The voters are electing lawmakers to the legislature as well as to local offices across the nation. Opinion polls show that a tight race with Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson having the edge. Her Social Democratic Party, has been in power since 2014, but his popularity has been dwindling. Campaigning in the current elections has seen parties battle to be the toughest on gang crime. Sweden now tops European statistics for firearm deaths. Soaring inflation and the energy crisis in the wake of the war in Ukraine have also taken center stage. Polls will close at 8 p.m. with the final results due around midnight. Millions of pilgrims from across the world are converging on Iraq's holy city of Karbala for the annual commemoration of Arba'in. Pilgrims, many of them from Iran, are making the journey toward Karbala on foot. The city houses the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, the pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the 17th of September. Arba'in marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. The Imam, along with dozens of his companions, were killed during the Battle of Karbala nearly 14 centuries ago. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in the year 2001 following the 9/11 attacks and as part of its so-called War on Terror. The invasion led to the toppling of the Taliban regime back then. But 20 years later, the Taliban actually has taken back power in the country, devastated by the war, which had left tens of thousands of civilians dead. The following report takes a look at why the Afghan war lasted for so long and is considered as one of the biggest U.S. failures.
The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by Osama bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country. And the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost. And we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
Well, since the war on terror, the so-called war on terror began in 2001, the U.S. claimed to have captured or killed hundreds of terrorists. The reports show that the number of terror groups has actually increased, despite trillions of dollars being spent to uproot them. It comes in addition to almost a million people who were killed in different countries as a result of America's so-called war on terror.
The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the U.S. Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped U.S.'s foreign policy. The U.S. also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the U.S. to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the U.S. claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The U.S. war on terror goes beyond the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the U.S. and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The U.S. is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The war on so-called war on terror was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., public health agencies generally don't test sewage for polio. Instead, they wait for people to show up sick in doctors' offices or hospitals, a reactive strategy that can give this stealthy virus more time to circulate silently through the community before it is detected. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Robin Fields Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. reactive polio strategy could be silently putting many at risk. Here's more. Polio's first appearance in almost a decade in the U.S., confirmed late last week by health officials in New York, would play out quite differently. In the U.S., public health agencies generally don't test sewage for polio. Instead, they wait for people to show up sick in doctors' offices or hospitals, a reactive strategy that can give this stealthy virus more time to circulate silently through the community before it is detected. In New York, the first sign of trouble surfaced when a young man in Rockland County sought medical treatment for weakness and paralysis in June. By the time tests confirmed he had polio, nearly a month had passed. Because the majority of polio infections cause no symptoms, by the time there is a case of paralysis, 100 to 1,000 infections may have occurred, said Dr. Ivan Malando, a professor of pediatrics at Stanford School of Medicine, who chairs the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. He said, "You are already chasing your tail if you're going to wait for a case to show up." Nationally and globally, there are signs that the pandemic has opened up new vulnerabilities to diseases long in retreat. Routine immunizations have been hindered by a host of obstacles, including COVID-19-related lockdowns and growing vaccine resistance, stalked by misinformation and politicization. A recent analysis by UNICEF and the World Health Organization showed that the percentage of children worldwide who received all three doses of the vaccine against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, a measure of overall immunization, dropped 5 points between 2019 and 2021, and that measles in polio vaccinations fell too. The organization say that's the largest sustained decline in childhood vaccinations in the roughly 30 years they have been collecting data. That could create greater risk of polio, a scourge of the first half of the 20th century in the U.S., highly contagious and potentially life-threatening. Polio historically has victimized mostly young children, attacking their spinal cords, brain stems, or both. The virus spreads when fecal material or respiratory droplets from infected people get into water or food or onto other people's hands, which they then put into their mouth. This may sound unusual, but it's among the more common ways viruses circulate, especially among children. Around 70% of those who are infected show no signs of the illness but can infect others. Of those who do get sick, most have mild symptoms such as fever, sore throat, muscle weakness, and nausea. But about 5 in 1,000 infected people develop irreversible paralysis. At its peak in 1952, polio killed more than 3,000 Americans and paralyzed more than 20,000. Images of children encased in coffin-like iron lungs terrified parents. Those fears faded swiftly after the first polio vaccine was approved in 1955. Within 2 years, cases dropped by as much as 90%. Since 1988, when the Global Polio Eradication Initiative began pouring billions into immunization campaigns and surveillance around the world, polio has been eradicated in much of the rest of the world. While polio, the kind that occurs naturally, remains endemic in just two countries, including Pakistan and Afghanistan. But there is another kind of polio that's circulating, one linked to the type of vaccine that's used in much of the world, particularly lower-income countries. This oral vaccine, which hasn't been used in the U.S. since 2000, is easy to administer. Just a few drops on the tongue and cheap to make. It uses weakened live viruses to trigger the immune system to create protective antibodies. That brings a bonus. When the vaccinated shed the weakened live viruses in their stool, they can spread to the unvaccinated, triggering protective antibodies in them as well. But it also brings a risk. In rare instances, when the weakened viruses circulate in people who have not had the vaccine or are under-immunized, they revert to a form that can sicken unvaccinated people, causing the disease they were meant to prevent. The injectable polio vaccine used in the U.S. contains only inactivated viruses and cannot cause this. Cases of vaccine-derived polio have surged in recent years after global health authorities in 2016 decided to remove one strain of polio from the oral vaccine after determining that the wild version had been eradicated globally. That left a growing number of children with no immunity to the vaccine-derived version of that strain, type 2. Type 2 vaccine-derived poliovirus is the kind that was found in sewage samples. It was also the kind that infected the unvaccinated Rockland County man, indicating a transmission chain from someone who received the oral polio vaccine, health officials said in New York. Officials are still investigating where the man caught the virus, in the U.S. or abroad. The Washington Post has reported that the man traveled to Poland and Hungary this year, but a spokesperson for the Rockland County Health Department said in an email the person did not travel outside the country during what would have been the incubation window. Ultimately, New York health officials will use wastewater monitoring to tell them quickly whether they have a bigger problem, essentially allowing them to test thousands of people at once for polio infection rather than individually. David Larson, an epidemiologist and Syracuse University professor who directs the state's wastewater surveillance network, said in an email. Wastewater testing for polio has been a staple in developing nations for decades, but at least a few countries where cases are rare and vaccination rates are high to do it too. COVID-19 has triggered a blast of interest in wastewater surveillance, prompting cities, states, and colleges to launch programs and opening a floodgate of funding for them. The CDC sent federal money to health departments in over 40 jurisdictions to support such tracking efforts, working with them to collect data that's published on the agency's National Wastewater Surveillance System website. A spokesperson said in an email that the agency was working to expand the platform to include data on other pathogens, from foodborne infections like Salmonella to influenza, but not polio. Testing nationally for polio would be labor and resource intensive, requiring increases in public health lab capacity, the spokesperson said. One asset of wastewater monitoring is the ability to pivot quickly to test something new. In November 2020, the SUER Coronavirus Alert Network, based on Stanford and Emory Universities started daily monitoring at California wastewater plants for the virus that causes COVID-19. It's since added monitoring for other pathogens, including COVID-19 variants, the common respiratory virus RSV, and most recently, monkeypox. Such additions are relatively economical since the network can test for multiple pathogens from a single sample, said Malrin Wolf, one of the two principal investigators and an assistant professor at the Rowling School of Public Health at Emory. In adding more tests, Wolf said, the question is always whether monitoring a disease this way is likely to service anything of enough concern to drive public health decisions. Many question whether the expansion of wastewater testing fueled by the pandemic will last. Malondo, the American Academy of Pediatrics Infectious Diseases Committee Chair, said the recent polio case is another signal that more disease tracking is critical, saying, maybe this is a clarion call for us to really restart building better surveillance networks.
Your horse returns to Alcamp Riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام، زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
ولعن الله آل زياد وآل مروان، ولعن الله بني أمية قاطبة، ولعن الله ابن مرجان، ولعن الله عمر بن سعد.
Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we discussed this beginning part of this phrase, وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ وَآلَ مَرْوَانٍ. May Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Marwan. About these two sentences, it is important for us to realize that when we say آل زِيَاد, آل مَرْوَان, we do not mean the entire lineage of Marwan and Ziyad, regardless of their character and personality. The true Al-Ziyad and Al-Marwan are those among the progeny of Marwan and Ziyad who resembled them in their character and personality, who have a common belief with them, those who are content with what happened in that time, and those who are pleased with the atrocities of this time. So that is why we say time and place cannot limit Al-Ziyad and Al-Marwan. When we ask Allah to distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Yazid, we certainly mean the ones who believe in the same way they believed. And we, of course, do not mean those who are from their lineage, but believe in the path of the Ahlul Bayt. Now, we can move on to the next part. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ بَنِي أُمَيَّةَ قَاطِبَهُ. May Allah distance from His mercy the progeny of Umayyah altogether. Banu Umayyah literally means the sons of Umayyah. The word Bani or Banu is the plural form of Ibn. In the Arabic, when we say Banu, we do not only mean the immediate male offspring, but rather the entire progeny. That is why Banu Umayyah would signify the progeny of Umayyah. The word Umayyah is the diminutive form of the word Amah. Diminutive means the musaggar of the form Amah. Amah means slave girl. The esteemed Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, in his magnum opus of light, Al-Ghadir, narrates this interesting report. Shariq ibn A'war, who was an ugly man, entered the presence of Muawiyah, whereupon Muawiyah said to him, "Indeed, you are ugly, and the one who is handsome is better than the one who is ugly. Then you are Shariq, partner, and Allah does not have Shariq, Allah does not have a partner. And indeed, your father is A'war, when it means one-eyed, and one who is sound is better than A'war. How did you become the leader of your community?" Thereupon, Shariq said to him in response, "Indeed, you are the son of Sakhr or Rock, and a soft ground or Sahl is better than indeed what you are. And indeed, you are the son of Harb, which literally means war, and peace is better than war. And indeed, you are the son of Umayyah, and Umayyah is none save a slave girl who has been degraded. And how did you, tell me, become the commander of the faithful?"
When people ask, "I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right," go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, "I'm confused," say, "Please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion." You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is: do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So, we all know the true meaning of Bani and Umayyah now, also the true meaning of La'an. Now, the word Qatibah. Defining the root of the word Qatibah, Ibn Faris, in his Mu'jam, says, "Al-Qaf wa-ta wa-al-ba, aslun sahih yadullu ala al-jam'." This qataba is a sound root that signifies to gather. Yuqal, "Ja'atil Arabu qatiba, idha ja'at bi-ajma'iha." It is said that the Arabs came qatiban when they came all together. So the word qatiban in the phrase Bani Umayyata qatibah is what describes the state of Banu Umayyah. It means all together. Hence, the meaning of the phrase under discussion would be, and may Allah distance from His mercy the progeny of Umayyah altogether. لعن الله بني أمية قاطبة. Now, in order to have a better understanding of this part of Ziyaratul Ashura, first, I assume we'd have to get a better understanding of Umayyah and then his progeny. So, we will, God willing, in the next episode, start to have a look at what history tells us about Umayyah's personality and also Banu Umayyah in the Holy Quran. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
It seems that the unfavorable situation of the American economy, which is now facing high inflation and unprecedented recession, has caused the concern of the U.S. administration and prompted the White House to increase the sale of arms and ammunition to its foreign allies and partners around the world. These actions are contrary to President Joe Biden's previous promises. According to the latest reports by U.S. media, in the midst of the American economic crisis and the trade war with China, Joe Biden decided to increase U.S. arms sales and lift the ban on arms exports to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. This is whilst numerous reports of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition against innocent people in Yemen have been published. We now take a look at some of the world press and news agencies' coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. World Socialist website writes, just a few weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia aimed at shoring up relations with the Riyadh regime, his administration has approved two massive arms sales worth more than $5 billion to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. It follows $650 million in air-to-air missiles sent to Riyadh in November of 2021 for its criminal war against the civilian population in Yemen. Included in these sales are Patriot missiles costing $3 billion for Saudi Arabia and a high-altitude missile system costing $2.2 billion for the United Arab Emirates, aimed at protecting the monarchs from rocket attacks. Joe Biden has pledged during his election campaign to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah state due to its appalling human rights record, and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman signing off on Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi's gruesome assassination in 2018. He also promised to cut off or cut back on the sale of offensive weapons to both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, citing their attacks on innocent people in Yemen. But this has counted for nothing next to the more pressing needs of Washington's geostrategic interests. Ever since Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates-led coalition invaded Yemen in April of 2015, international human rights groups, including the New York-based Human Rights Watch and the London-based Campaign Against the Arms Trade, have documented the coalition's use of American and British weapons in unlawful airstrikes, including undoubted war crimes, breaching Washington and London's own policies on arms sales. The antiwar.com website explains more about this issue. Recently, the Biden administration announced over $2.8 billion in military aid for Ukraine and U.S. allies in the region. The announcement came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a surprise visit to Kiev, and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin chaired a meeting of defense ministers in Germany. In Kiev, Antony Blinken met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and other officials and said the administration was providing $2.2 billion in foreign military financing for Ukraine and 17 other countries in the region. Foreign military financing is a State Department program that gives money to foreign governments that they can use to purchase American-made military equipment. The $2.2 billion is being pulled from the $40 billion Ukraine aid bill President Biden signed in May, which authorized $4 billion for foreign military financing. According to the Associated Press, about $1 billion of the $2.2 billion will go to Ukraine. The remaining funds will be divided among Albania, Bulgaria, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Georgia, Greece, Kosovo, Latvia, Lithuania, Moldova, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia. over the Ramstein Air Base in Germany. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin told a group of officials representing over 50 countries, known as the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, that President Biden approved a new $675 million weapons package for Ukraine. Lloyd Austin claimed that the U.S. and its allies are seeing the demonstrable success of their support for Ukraine on the battlefield. But Ukraine is taking heavy losses in its southern counteroffensive and doesn't appear to be regaining territory. Moreover, a recent Wall Street Journal report revealed that the Pentagon has launched a wide-ranging push to expedite the sales of U.S. arms, including drones, guns, helicopters, tanks, and other weaponry, to foreign allies in an effort to better compete with China and refill the arsenals of friendly nations that have given military gear to Ukraine. The Pentagon recently created a task force of senior officials, known as Tiger Team, to examine long-standing inefficiencies in U.S. sales of billions of dollars of weaponry to foreign countries. According to a senior defense official, the Tiger Team will look at ways for Defense Department to streamline parts of the program with the aim of putting American weapons into partners' and allies' hands faster. The United States promised European allies who have provided military equipment to Ukraine that it would be able to replenish their stocks. But the U.S. defense industry is facing a backlog. Meanwhile, the European Union's foreign policy chief says member states are running low on weapons because of the scale of arms deliveries to Ukraine. Joe Biden's biggest promise in the 2020 election campaign was to restore America's global position with the interactive approach and expand cooperation with other countries. However, contrary to his pacifist election slogans, Joe Biden has appeared more as a broker of violence. Washington has increased military aid and arms sales to places like Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea, and under the pretext of confronting China, is reviving American military exercises with these countries. Japan is considering deploying 1,000 long-range cruise missiles to strengthen its counterattack capability against China. South Korea has also demanded an increase in military and weapons support from the United States, while, at the request of the United States, Seoul and Tokyo participated in the NATO summit for the first time. The AUKUS agreement with Australia in the form of building a nuclear submarine for Australia, along with increasing military cooperation under pretext of countering China's movements in maritime security, also forms another dimension of U.S. militarism. In addition to deepening internal differences, Joe Biden has actually intensified the atmosphere of tension on the world stage, which can be seen in the war in Ukraine, the crisis in Taiwan, and the American tensions in West Asia.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.